The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
To wash Rocky out of people's heads, you had to do something serious, right? Like you had to, yeah, you did some serious damage with those sequels.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined as always by the voice of CinemaSins, Jeremy Scott.
Hello!
And from Music Video Sins, Barrett Sher.
Bonjour!
Yes, indeed.
Bonjour.
It's been a couple weeks, so I'm sure you guys have gotten riled up about something.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills!
I'm as mad as hell!
You've never seen me very upset.
I gotta find my show notes.
You know, Jeremy and I are probably riled up about something very recently because we just decided to venture out into our icy, treacherous roadways to go to the grocery store. And let me tell you something, wherever you think your drivers are worst people in Louisiana and LA and New Jersey and Kentucky and St. Louis and Chicago, fuck you. Fuck you. Nashville has the worst drivers. Nashville has the worst drivers, especially in snow. So fuck you. That's actually not my rant. Okay. My real rant is something that you guys were just talking about before we started the show here. And it's the online fervor that seems to be growing each episode of the show WandaVision not revealing who their, quote, big bad is. And I think these guys are cockasses for even posing this question.
They are cockasses, for sure.
I understand it, I think. When you had a series such as this from, say, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you always had kind of an idea of who the big bad was. At this point, which is about two-thirds of the way through the show, even with Lost, you kind of knew at least there was a big smoke monster out there, and then so on and so forth. But the whole point of WandaVision, I think, so far, is to build that suspense. We don't need to see Ultron being built at the beginning of the movie, in the case of Age of Ultron, and then track him all the way through. We don't have to see, you know, Bucky as the Winter Soldier show up, you know, 15 minutes in, so we know what Cap is dealing with. This show is not about that. This show is more about the relationships between these characters, how it fits into a new narrative. And to do that, it takes a little bit of time, man. It's been six goddamn episodes since episode three. You could say even since episode one, but since episode three for sure. You've started getting answers, and that should be satisfying. It keeps you wanting to go back for more, but it also gives you some answers and some perspective. So stop being cockasses and enjoy the ride, because it'll be over soon, and then you'll have something else to bitch about.
I don't remember anyone complaining about The Mandalorian being slow or not revealing its big bad by episode five or any of that shit. Like, there's almost some kind of misogyny tinged in here, I think, with the lead being Wanda, that she has to prove her show more than, you know, The Mandalorian. It doesn't make much sense to me. And this is also, I think people need to realize, Marvel's probably not going to make shows the way we're used to shows being made. They're making miniseries, movies, and I think Falcon and Winter Soldier is going to be much the same thing. I think Loki is going to be much the same thing. And yeah, people are cockasses. They need to chill. It's like, why are you so impatient? Why are you so impatient?
Yeah.
Why are you so impatient?
I will say specifically about that example, Mandalorian, though, that wasn't one where they needed to unleash a big bad of some sort. It's such an episodic TV show that they didn't really need to have, like, oh, there's this Giancarlo Esposito in the background, you know, or anything like that. But I know it, but your point still holds, though, and that is, you know, the mystery is often better than the answer, right? Like just enjoy the ride and everything. The answer is, a lot of times, if you really like the show and how it's going about it, and once they reveal everything, then you can watch it with that knowledge the next time you want. And it's going to be just as good to you. Yeah. You're not even going to remember that you were like, oh my God, it took them so long and all that, because once you watch it again, you'll know. So that's the way I feel about those type of things a lot of times. I thought about that while watching the latest season of Rick and Morty when it came out. Each episode has this pressure on it, and you can see the writers have the pressure on to try to make the best Rick and Morty they've ever made, or the most transcendental Rick and Morty that they can find, or whatever. And about three or four episodes in, it gets tiresome. But then you realize, you'll watch these in reruns someday. It's not even going to matter, all that pressure and all that. And, you'll just watch the episode as it is, and it's totally fine. So,
well, this is a very cool experience. And I don't, Chris, have you made it through to the current episode?
I'm past episode six. Yeah, I'm waiting for seven, like everybody else.
I have prevented myself from getting too many spoilers so far in this season. I didn't know who the surprise guest was at the end of, I think, episode five. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it caused me to say, whoa, hold on one second. And then I went back and I read a bunch of stuff. There's very few shows that make me want to seek out supplemental information. And this is one of them. I have read some fan theories. I've read some very informed theories, especially around the House of M, that make this potential big bad revelation make some sort of sense. And if so, it would be very, very cool. But if so, I will be glad to have waited until then to figure that out. And you're absolutely right, Chris. I will enjoy going back through the show and being like, oh, now that I have this context, I really want to watch this thing again.
Yeah.
And if they do what a lot of people are suggesting they're going to do, I can't wait to see how A, it plays out, and B, how it affects the rest of the phase. Are we in phase four now? I think we're in phase.
Fuck knows.
I think this is supposed to get us into phase four, is what I've understood. This to be, but maybe this is phase four, and we missed the bridge. That's what I thought it was. So.
But man, I'm having so much fun with this, and I don't want my fun delayed. I don't want to prematurely get the villain exposed to me. I want that to be a nice, like, edging technique that finally explodes with pleasure.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you briefly, because I've talked about this online before, and maybe on a podcast before, but your boycott is largely performative and worthless. and people like to scream, boycotts work, and they really don't. Bad publicity works, but boycotts don't. I remember two very prominent Christian-led boycotts of Disney in the 90s. One for the film The House of Yes, that was a Miramax film.
That's a wild movie.
Kiss. And then once when Disney decided to offer extend benefits to same-sex partners of their employees at the parks. Disney, last I checked, doing better than ever. Your boycotts did nothing to stop them. latest boycott is Publix, because the heiress of Publix gave $300,000 to this capital insurrection. Now, she's not an employee of Publix. She's an heiress. So again, this is like getting mad at Hilton Hotels because Paris Hilton does something you don't like. And I made the mistake of including the hashtag when I tweeted, So I got a few people who were only looking at the tag, who don't follow me, who wanted to fight. And one person was like, well, where does she get her money? From Publix. And I'm like, this is my real rant. You people suck at math. And you cannot just draw a line wherever you want and say, this is where the real money is, right? So if we blame Publix for how the heiress spends her money, then you have to blame me because I shop at Publix. And if you want to blame me, you have to blame YouTube because they give me my money. And if you want to blame YouTube, you have to blame Coca-Cola and all the Fortune 500 people that advertise on YouTube. And guess what? You can't shop anywhere now. So if you try and play follow the money from some bad deed with money, it's a fool's game. And you're just wasting everyone's time, right? If you honestly want to shop at only places that agree with everything you agree with politically, you're fucked. You can't do it. Good luck dying. I wish you the best. But if you want to be a practical person, then you must realize every day you do business with somebody who doesn't agree with you politically. And that's called humanity. And your boycott is largely worthless and performative. That's the end of my rant.
Well, and when you boycott Publix, you're also boycotting all the employees that work there who, you know, and again, even then, like you said at the very top, your boycott is basically worthless anyway. So
yes, and I was even told. Well, aside from the Capitol riot, Publix gave money to the governor of Florida, and so I went digging and I found that Kroger gave $100,000 to Trump. And
I was about to say, how is any store going to get unscathed in this?
Exactly. So, and that was my last tweet. Walmart gave $500,000 to Trump. So do I just shop at the place that gave the least to the evil people or what? Yeah. You can't live your life this way. And honestly, especially in the age of social media, anybody on social media who's telling you they're boycotting something is probably lying, because there are an awful lot of people who said they were going to drop Netflix forever because of that Cuties debacle. And guess what? Mm-hmm. Netflix is doing just fine. So, you know, fuck you.
Well, and the same thing goes for sports too. Like, you know, like I'm never watching the NFL again because people were kneeling. Yeah. And like, you hear these same people go, God damn it, the Falcons, man, pissing me off. And they're like, well, why are you watching? You didn't like the kneeling. And then, and there was somebody who always railed against the NBA. Like, I can't remember who it was, like Ben Shapiro or somebody like that. And like somebody went back and found like every tweet he'd ever made about the NBA, and like all of them were like, I'm going to start watching the NBA because blah, 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 blah. I'm going to stop watching the NBA. Like, there was like hundreds of those.
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously just for attention, but yeah, I remember the whole boycott Nike thing after they signed Kaepernick to that big deal. Mm-hmm. Is Nike hurting right now? No. No, they're not.
No, that's what I'm saying. You could take any company that was in the headlines the last 4 years that, with the word boycott, whether it's the Goya beans or the fucking throw your Keurig out or whatever. All those companies are doing just fine because it's just performative outrage on social media.
And it's a waste of time. You're absolutely right. It's a waste of time. Who benefits from this? From you, you know, writing with that tweet or Instagram story or whatever, and then arguing with the people that disagree with you. What is the point of all that? Is it just, is this how we get our jollies off? Or is this just, you know,
how we get our jollies off?
We just point at people who are less moral than us. That's all we do anymore.
We gotta think about time as currency. And I don't want to go too far off in like Justin Timberlake in time land. But you got to think of time as currency. What's worth more? Like a little bit of extra money for a tip for an Uber Eats person, or your time spent to go get that, be in traffic,
man,
possibly have
you
it come
are
home
preaching
cold.
My gospel right now, baby.
There's like, nothing more important in your life than time.
Agreed.
And I if will you pay can somebody save time by not doing something superfluous. Now, sometimes we all need times to jerk off or sit on the couch or jerk off on the couch. Mm-hmm. But like, also, use your time wisely. Don't get into these bullshit arguments that don't mean anything.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't done my own taxes in 15 years because to me, that time of not being aggravated is worth whatever it costs me to pay the guy who does my taxes. Mm-hmm. And I have, yeah. I have felt this way for 10, 15 years. Like I just don't, I don't do things where spending that time drives me crazy. So I don't mow my own lawn. I'll mow my own lawn if I ever have to, but I don't have to. And that time, that 2 hours is better spent on me writing or doing something else. So I'll pay somebody to do that.
And if mm-hmm. you're poor, don't think this is just for people who are doing well and financially. If you're poor, find out what is most important to you to complete yourself and then figure out how to pay for the rest of it. You can do this both if you're rich, middle class, poor, anything like that.
Yeah, it's
your
not,
time
it's not
is
really...
still valuable.
And I hijacked it and made it about money, but your point was not even really about money at all. It was just that that your time is the most important thing that you have, certainly more important than a piece of paper money that mm-hmm. will disappear. And so, yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. Do you have a rant mm-hmm. today, Chris?
I do, although the last time I ranted about video games, somebody came on Facebook and is like, a rant about Red Dead Redemption, huh? And gave me the teeth. You know, that teeth thing, that like that emoji,
it
is. You know, like, and I was just like, fuck you. This is our show. Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to I'm going to rant about any goddamn thing.
I'm glad to hear it.
But this is another video game rant. I got some games for Christmas, and basically I'm not on the pulse of video games, like what are popular and all that. I just go to I go to Google or something like that and say, what are the best games for Nintendo Switch right now? And, mm-hmm. You know, I start seeing some patterns and I'm like, okay, that one's been showing up a bunch. That one shows up a bunch. That one shows up a bunch. So I ended up getting I got four games for Christmas. And one of them for the Nintendo Switch I got is apparently like one of the big quarantine hits. It's Animal Crossing.
Oh yeah. Ooh. Oh yeah. All over the place.
Yeah. Now, I didn't know anything about Animal Crossing. All I saw was good reviews and all of that. And I have played it fairly extensively for the last 3 weeks, probably somewhere around there. I don't know, maybe longer. And there are elements to it that I really can enjoy. You know, I like going around, running around this island, fishing, you know, digging things up, planning things, all these other different things. But there is, and I'm not the first to talk about this, but there is a flaw in this game that is nearly fatal to how you play it. Whenever you go in and you need to do anything, interact with another character, for instance, there's a museum that gets built and you can go and donate like fossils you find, animals, insects, all this stuff to the museum. You go in and you talk to this owl named Blathers, basically. And like every interaction you have in that game is, hey, what are you doing today? Blah, 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 blah. And you have to sit there and press buttons to get through this text. And it's like this. And you hit the button. Blah, 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 blah. And then finally it gives you a menu where you have questions that you can ask. And then it's like, assess fossils is one of them. And so the assess fossils, you go in through and the guy's like, and he's like, and then after he assesses them, he goes, well, if you want to make a donation, that'd be great. I'm here to give you the fucking fossils. Just let me go in and say, like, can I have a button that says assess and donate? Because that's what I fucking want. I just want to go in, give them let him assess it. He can tell me about the fossils if he wants to. And then I donate it. Instead, after he assesses them, he's like, I hope you'll want to donate them. And then it goes back to the menu and it goes, okay, what do you want to do? And it's like, all right, I want to make a donation. And it's like, oh, Jesus. I'm so glad that you're making this donation, blah, 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 blah. And there's never a shorthand. It never ends. It's always the same interaction over and over and over again. And you go into stores and you want to sell stuff, and the fucking raccoons that are in there that sell the stuff, they're always like, oh, look at all these wonderful things that you brought in today. Let me do some figuring. And he goes in this little thing where he's like figuring the amount that he's going to give you for all the stuff you're giving him and everything. And it's like, can I just go in and say, I want to sell? He doesn't deny anything. You can sell anything you want to in this game. So it's not, why can't I just go in and say sell and just hit all the buttons and go boom, and then they just give me money and I don't have to go all this and forwarding through it so that I can get to the fucking menus that I need to get to. And then and like every interaction has to have like two extra lines of dialogue that it doesn't fucking need. Just let me do my fucking shit and let me go. I don't have to sit here through fucking the same text over and over. Whenever you go out and fish and you catch something, there's this big animation where it's like, woohoo, I caught a dab. That's not bad. Or, you know, it's like, I caught a sea bass. It's at least a C+, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's saying these stupid ass fucking punny jokes every single time. Like, and then if your inventory is full, it'll let you pick something up and then it'll go, oh, I found this and it's great, but my inventory is full and blah, blah, blah. Why can't you just say, no, you can't pick this fucking shit up because your inventory is full. Anyway, I hate the fucking dialogue in Animal Crossing. I wish it would die. This game would be super fun if you could just get through that shit without having to go through all that dialogue every single fucking time you do something.
I've heard of a lot of people, especially when the pandemic started, using mm-hmm. this game to calm down, mm-hmm. calm their anxiety. It sounds mm-hmm. like it worked the exact opposite way on you. Mm-hmm.
Because every time you go in, you're sitting there like, is there a fast forward through this, please? All I want to do is the thing and then leave. I don't need a fucking story.
I hear you, man. That sounds very infuriating.
There's different versions. They update this game, so you know that they've had complaints about this.
Yep.
How in the world can they not come up with a version where you just go up into this? Hey, we have a new feature today. You can fast forward through all of our bullshit, and I'd be like, yes.
What were the other games that you got, by the way, just out of curiosity?
I got Streets of Rage 4. I played that first. I played the original Streets of Rage that was on the Genesis.
Oh, wow. Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Streets of Rage 4, played that quite a bit for a while, to the point when my thumbs lost their skin, basically, and everything. And then I played Luigi's Mansion 3.
Nice.
I had
nice.
Not played the other Luigi's Mansions, but I really enjoyed that game. Luigi's Mansion 3 was really fun. And now I'm on this. There's another game that I have gotten that I haven't played yet, and it's the the Cadence of Hyrule is what it's called.
Oh, a Zelda game?
I think it's based on Zelda, but it's not a Zelda game.
Interesting.
And I haven't gotten into the gameplay yet, so I don't know exactly how it goes. And also for my birthday, I got a couple more that are waiting in the wings. So
nice.
One's like Hollow Knight, and another one is what was the other one? I don't remember what the other one was called, but I have a few waiting in the wings. I don't know when I will quit Animal Crossing because it's kind of it's almost a Sim City kind of game overall. Yeah. I don't know where it ends because you can keep adding stuff to your house and you can like decorate it and more people come over to the island and all that. So I don't know where the ending is for that game, if there is even an ending. So there may be a point where I'm just like, okay, I'm tired of this. I'm going to start playing another game. So
Nice. All right. Well, I'm sure this rant will get to the creators of Animal Crossing and they'll be like, mm-hmm. You know what? He's right. He's mm-hmm. right. We should have been doing this the whole time. And you may have changed the world, my friend.
I may have. No, it's not that hard. You've played games. You've played games before where you can just go and do a thing and then leave. It doesn't make you sit through fucking, you know, Goodfellas to get to the end of it. Are we ready for some recommends and warns?
Recommends and warns.
Totes amaze balls.
They're great.
It won the Academy Award.
Oh, for what?
For best movie ever made.
I'll go first, since you asked. Nobody asked. I watched a movie two days ago called Liberal Arts.
Mm-hmm.
This is your classic Jeremy scrolling through the movie channels,
sees a recent film with people in it that he likes that he's never heard of or seen. So this is it Josh Radner? Is that the name of the guy from How I Met Your Mother?
Yeah.
So he wrote, directed, and stars in this film. And it's very, who's the Scrubs guy that made movies?
Zach Braff.
It's very Zach Braffy. These two guys make the same kind of movies. Elizabeth Olsen is in this, and fuck my ass. I don't want to fuck up another name, but I don't. It's Richard somebody. Richard
Gear.
He's in Cabin in the Woods with Bradley Whitford.
Oh, Jenkins?
Jenkins. Richard Jenkins is in this. So basically, Radner is this guy who's about 30, and he's dissatisfied with his life. And Jenkins is the old retiring professor from the college where Radner went to school. And he goes back to the college for this guy's retirement ceremony and meets Elizabeth Olsen, who is a sophomore student at the college. And the rest of the movie is him and Elizabeth Olsen trying to think about having a relationship, but getting cold feet. And she eventually asks him to fuck her, and he says no, and she gets mad that he wouldn't fuck her. And then by the end, everyone realizes he did the right thing by not fucking her, and they're still friends, and they write letters to each other. I do not understand why people make movies like this about a 30-year-old who contemplates fucking an 18-year-old and then decides not to and ends up happy. Why? What is the point of this fucking movie? Does every 30-year-old out there who's single actually fantasize about having a relationship with a college sophomore? I feel like I've seen this movie 8 different times under different names. And it, like, there's actually a movie with Rooney Mara in it called Tanner Hall. And it's got that thing you do in it. God, I haven't even smoked any weed.
Tom Everett Scott.
Tom Everett Scott. And he kisses her, and he's married and a 30-year-old, and she's a high school student, I think. And he like flirts, thinks about having a relationship with her, and then realizes in the end, no, that's not right. And everybody's happy. And I don't understand these fucking movies. Like, this is not a journey I can relate to. And it feels like there must be a lot more people who can relate to it out there. Or else why would you make this movie? And I just don't understand it. It's trying to be slice of lifey, and it didn't do it for me.
Is it very clear that he's 30 and she's 18, 19?
Abundantly clear, yes.
Abundantly. So he's like a professional, or he's like in the workplace and things like that.
He lives in New York. He actually just keeps driving back to Pennsylvania or wherever the fuck. It doesn't tell you where the school is, just to see her and have coffee and flirt.
Is the romance portrayed as creepy or justified? Like, why? What is the reason that they cannot be together? Is the age difference?
Yes. And that she's too young to know what she really wants.
Oh, I see.
And isn't there some line in there where she says something about liking Twilight or something like that? Isn't there a big thing about Twilight in there?
They do discuss Twilight, yes.
Yeah, and he says something about how trash it is, and she tells him the sort of the hidden genius of it, or maybe not the hit. I don't remember. I just remember there being a Twilight conversation.
Well, and she does the whole disagreement. Age ain't nothing but a number spiel, but there is one great line that I liked where he's explaining to her why he can't sleep with her and explaining that he feels guilt. And she says, we haven't done anything yet. And he says, yeah, I know, guilt before you act is called morality. And I thought, wow, that's a really good line. But that's it. That's all I took away from that movie that I enjoyed. it doesn't go hard enough in any of its, like, it tries to have Richard Jenkins try and commit suicide because he doesn't actually want to retire. And then Josh Radner saves him. And there's like a student on campus who Josh Radner sees himself in, and they have conversations that are weird. I don't understand this movie. I don't understand why this movie was made or who it was made for. I cannot relate to any of these characters.
No, I think I understand now. You don't think it didn't state a position, right? It didn't say like a narrative position, right? It didn't say I'm going to commit to doing this or I'm going to commit to doing that. It was just like, eh, nothing really happens. They flirt for a little while. He goes about his business and off they go. I understand that. Had they had the relationship flourish between a 30-year-old and a 19-year-old or something like that? I don't know if that's out of line.
I'm not saying it's out of line. I mean, I'm not saying it's out of line. The movie is.
I see. I see what you're saying. And thereby it abides by its own principles.
And the, yeah,
or
and the,
this guy abides by its own principles.
Yeah, I just don't, I don't know who this movie was made for or what it's trying to say, except that sometimes when you feel like fucking a teenager, don't, and you'll meet a pretty bookish lady at the bookstore by the end of the film. I mean, I'm warning this movie. This is not a wreck a warn, this is a warn, but I'm not saying the movie is poor quality. The acting is good. The writing is, the dialogue is snippy, snappy, whatever it's supposed to be. I didn't like it. I didn't like the experience, and I felt bad when I was done. Like, I had just, like the movie made me root for them, only to realize that I was an asshole for rooting for them because their age difference was so,
yeah.
So, there you go. That's my warn for today.
Oh, wow. Talk about a waste of time.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's a bunch of people out there, a bunch of writers out there who have like, man, I had a chance with that 18-year-old girl when I was 30 and I just didn't go through with it. Now I'm going to write something about that.
It's not unlike Beautiful Girls where, you know, he's like, he doesn't ever flirt with Natalie Portman, but it's very clear that he wishes he could.
Yeah,
and then at the end of the movie, he realizes, no, that would have been bad. I'll go back to my girlfriend of 5 years, and that'll make me happy. I just don't understand. Awesome.
Yeah, there's that scene where it really puts it in perspective in Beautiful Girls, where Timothy Hutton is telling Noah Emmerich, I'm telling you, this girl's going to be amazing when she grows up and everything. And Noah Emmerich's like, the girl was a zygote when you were in sixth grade.
That movie has a lot of great lines in it, but yeah, that's a perfect line.
Thank God, man. This just came up when we were doing Phantom of the Opera, the film version, the Schumacher version. It's supposed to be so chaste and virginal when Emmy Rossum is like, we used to be childhood sweethearts with Patrick Wilson. But like, he's 13 years older than her in real life, but like, you can see the age difference. He's already like a Vicomte or something like that in Paris. Mm-hmm. He would be in his early 20s and she would be 7.
Yeah.
When they became childhood sweethearts. Mm-hmm. And fuck you for even putting that image in my head.
Yeah. It's not good.
I'm going to recommend this. I'm trying to remember if this is on Netflix. Is it on Amazon Prime? The Derek Del Guadio's In of Itself?
It's on Hulu.
It's on Hulu. Okay.
Yeah.
So this movie is on Hulu. It's Derek Del Guadio's In and of Itself. He is a magician, but it's sort of this show is a sort of a storytelling, kind of a magic show. Magic is sort of maybe 35% of it, maybe 40% of it. It's kind of like that. And this guy opens up by telling the audience about a story about a guy who was down on his luck and he didn't care anymore. So he started entering Russian roulette competitions, and he took the shot and he survived and he went on. He got a lot of money out of that. But apparently this guy kept wanting to go, which is something that nobody ever does or whatever. So he tells the story about the Russian roulette, tells about the guy who survived and everything like that. You will notice that he has 6 windows behind him that sort of represent chambers of a gun, I think, in some way. But it has a different image in each one. So he has a different thing he's going to do with each one of these. But he tells this story, but then it goes into other things and he starts doing some of these magic tricks while he's talking and everything. And there are some in there that I'm supposing he does some John Edwards type of stuff in this, where he sort of pre-interviews people or he has people out on the sidewalk talking to and they get like certain details and they make sure that these people get picked and a lot of this type of thing. But like, he brings out all these letters and you know, everybody's picked like who they are. There's like a little card that they pick at the beginning of the show, and they're supposed to pick whatever's closest to them. And then they put it all in a stack and put it on the table. And so like every show he's like, okay, who's my, you know, there's all sorts of different kinds of occupations and
like emotions. A reflection. Yeah. And things like that. Yeah.
And he's like, who's that or whatever. And so that person will come up and he's like, I know that there's someone very special to you who, you know, he gives them a letter. It's like, this has been mailed here. And so everybody who opens up this letter gets a letter from somebody that's actually to them very like, you know, like how in the world did they pick this person, you know, and everything. And they is usually telling them how they're proud of them and all this other stuff. Now, when I was hearing that, I was like, okay, they probably wrote a pretty generic letter. And then they started adding these little small things in there that made it seem like, oh, it really is this person. But as you watch these people read the letters, you just see the emotions that come out of them as they read it. And that's the story that you want to, you know, sort of focus on here. Not really so much how he did it, which is, I think is, you know, it's probably something pretty simple, but just the, how these people react to it. And he does that. Then later on, he goes in and he starts picking what everybody had out of their cards. And like these people have just taken a card and they put it in a stack, and all he does is go over and say, like, you're an entrepreneur and you're this. And it's like, you're like, holy shit, how is he doing this? But there's all sorts of other little magic tricks he does in there where you're just like jaw dropping. Like, how the fuck do you do this kind of thing? It's a very unusual show. It's one that just puts you, I'm not saying this to be punny, but it puts you under a spell. You're sitting there watching that and you're just transfixed during the whole time. As he tells stories about his own life and how he learned how he did some of the things he did, card tricks, how to become a card mechanic.
That part was really, really interesting. Just seeing the practicalities of that, not even any true sleight of hand. It gets to the sleight of hand in a little bit, you like how he learned how to shuffle these in all kinds of different ways, the grips that he uses and all that. It's that part is maybe the most fascinating part of this whole thing.
There's a point where he's dealing the things that he wants to deal out. And to show you how good this trick is, he actually flips the top card over and then he starts doing the deal, and it looks like it's coming straight off the top of the deck. Yeah. But the cards are underneath and he's making it look like it's coming off the top. And this like King of Spades is just sitting there the whole time.
And not even looking down. And that's part of the story where he was like, he went out to like a big high roller or a big magician type of guy. And he was like, man, I've been practicing my deal. I know how to do this. And so he's looking down and he's making sure everything is good. And the guy points a gun at him and he's like, what's the deal here? And he was like, you'd be shot for that because you're not, it's obvious that you're doing something there. You can't look down. And so everything he does is with his eyes up, and it's muscle memory. That's really cool to watch in action.
So yeah, watch it for some incredible magic tricks. Watch it for some great emotional revelations in the audience. There's a lot of celebrities in that audience. I didn't know that. I only remember seeing Bill Gates, but apparently there's like Kristen Wiig is in there and like a whole bunch of people when I looked at it. And there's a possibility I looked straight at some of these celebrities and didn't know that they were celebrities at the time, because they just blend into that crowd, or they've cut it so that those people don't show up. But there's a point where he's going through and he's telling everybody who they are and everything. He goes, and you're a leader. And then he's suddenly Bill Gates is sitting down. I'm like, what the fuck? I was like, is that Bill Gates? Is that somebody that looks like Bill Gates? No, it's Bill Gates.
Well, this is like the one guy says, my brother. And I'm like, oh, is that his brother? No, it's David Blaine, another magician.
Yeah.
Is this a show or a movie?
It's a movie.
It's a movie of a show.
Performance art thing, basically.
But it's like a 2-hour thing. It's not like a series.
It's an hour and a half.
Episodes. Okay.
It's an hour and a half. It was a show that he did in some theater in New York. And I guess it was like, 500 times he did it. Frank Oz is the credited director of the show.
God, that guy's had such a career, man.
Right?
Yeah, he has. He has. this is extremely well worth watching. It's something that will get you into it. I think it's a good mood. It's emotional. It's got a lot of unbelievable things in it that you're just sitting there like, oh my God, I can't believe how I just saw, I'm sitting there looking at it and I can't see how he's doing this at all, you know? So in and of itself,
awesome.
Give it a watch.
I tell you what, that Penn and Teller Fool Me show has ruined me for magic.
I know.
Like being in terms of being awed by a trick, right? Because now I know it's all a trick, right? You know, John Edwards is a dick because he's out there saying this is real, but you know, magicians aren't telling you it's real. They're just not telling you the secret. They just want you to be amazed, right? Like when in The Prestige, when he says, if people thought the things we did on stage were real, they'd be horrified. But I'm constantly looking for the method so fast now that I rarely have the time or take the time to be impressed by the trick. I really want to watch this. I think I'm going to watch it with my wife. And I will hope to turn that part of my brain off, but that Penn and Teller show has ruined magic.
Well, I think you'll be able to, because as Chris said, it's not really about the magic. The magic is a way by which he tells his stories.
Right. Right.
And it builds up some tension.
I've read that he's more of a storyteller. So.
Yeah. That's the one part I didn't love about this show is that it is emotional. And certainly the Confederates that come out, or maybe they're not Confederates, but the audience members that come up, and especially the letter scenes are very emotional. But there's a necessary level of artifice in the dude's performance that I think he's developed as a magician or a mentalist over time that I'm not buying every single thing.
I know what you're talking about, where he stares forlornly at the wall and, you know, all these little things that he does where it's like,
and he's like surprised by some of them. He's like, oh, what is this? Yeah.
So yeah, there are moments in there that are phony, but, a small amount.
And it's not really necessarily, it's a show about him, but it's not really about him. It's about all these other people that he's run into, call him the Ruletista. You still don't really ever get the answer of why he's the Ruletista.
No, I mean, there was a sort of tossed off explanation somewhere in the middle of all that, but like, it wasn't a satisfactory one. And he mentions that he was told this by the story of the Ruletista, he's relaying this to a sailor in a bar or something like that, or an old man in a bar or something like that.
The old man is telling him this story.
Old man is telling him the story. Yeah. And at the end, old man tells him he's the Ruletista and he didn't know why he was that or whatever. And I think there's a very small explanation he kind of skates over in the 2/3 of the way of the show. And you're like, but you made this sound like this was something that was a part of your life that just really changed the way you saw yourself and everything. You can't just toss off an explanation like that. You know, a lot of people having fun with toss off there. I know I am.
No, Jeremy, I think you and your wife would get a kick out of this.
Yeah. It's definitely on the list.
And try to spot all the famous people. I think Kate McKinnon's in the audience at one point. Mm-hmm. Kumail Bell is in there at one point. It's a fashionista guy, fashion boy, Gunn. Jim.
Oh, Gunn, yeah.
Peter Gunn.
Tim Gunn.
Top Gunn, Tim Gunn.
All right, everybody, it's time to talk about BetterHelp.
Yeah. BetterHelp, baby. You know how I was thinking about this after my last appointment? I felt good. I felt good afterwards. We didn't really break any new ground, but I was reminded of a lot of techniques that I've used in the past that have been successful to me. Stuff that is easy to forget, like, oh, you need to breathe for this amount of time every day. You need to exercise for this amount of time every day. You need to see your family for this amount of time every day. Sounds very intuitive, right? But I needed a checkup. I needed a little tune-up. And I was thinking about, like, you know, the times that you go to the dentist to get your teeth cleaned, nothing, you know, surgical or anything like that. Some people go to chiropractors. Some people go to physical therapy to get themselves worked on. And you go to the tune-up for your car. And I was like, sometimes you need those therapeutic experiences to tune up what you already know and to remind you of that stuff. And that's the beauty of counseling in general, and BetterHelp in particular, is that we're all human. We're all going to forget to do stuff. We don't always take the best care of ourselves. Sometimes we'd rather sit on the TV, sometimes we'd rather sit on the couch and watch TV than it would to read a book or to breathe or to exercise. And BetterHelp is there to remind you of, here's the things that we talked about. Here's what's worked. Go do those again and let me know if they're still working. If not, we could try something else. And man, do I need that. And the fact that it's in my home right now, and especially we're in an ice box right now in Nashville, as is much of the country, it's hard to get places. I can do a BetterHelp session or communicate with my counselor, licensed professional counselor, right this second if I wanted to. And that's the beauty of BetterHelp. I love it.
Yeah, I think I was telling my wife yesterday, who would have ever thought we'd have so many reasons to not go anywhere? You know, with a pandemic.
It's like the universe is conspiring.
And then an ice storm. Like, yeah, I guess we'll just stay here doubly so. One of the things I wanted to talk about briefly is expectations when you go into therapy. Because you're not every session is going to end with this whammy reveal where the rest of the day you're walking around going, how did I never realize this? Those kind of moments happen. Yeah. They happen intermittently. And there are plenty of sessions in between where if you analyze the actual session, you're like, well, I'm not sure what exactly I learned today, but I always feel better when I'm done. Always. And that is the power of a professional therapist because, you know, you can talk to your wife, you can talk to your friends, you can talk to your freaking dog, but therapists have been trained professionally on how to pick up what you're really saying through what you're saying and how to pick apart the pieces that matter most to your core and help you work towards bettering yourself. And, you know, some sessions will feel like work, some will feel like fun, and some will be euphoric and some will be difficult, but I always feel better, always, when I'm done.
You always do. And you talk about being able to pick that stuff out. What I do is the text option, like a text chat with my counselor every week. And that's for my privacy. That's so I don't disturb other people in my household that are doing stuff. And my counselor can pick out from all those ramblings what the real issue that I'm trying to get at is, because I write a lot. And she's great. The service has been great. Go to betterhelp.com/sincast. Get 10% off your first month. Use that month wisely. We believe in this product. Trust me, you've heard us talk about it before. Go to betterhelp.com/sincast. Get started now. Do it. Well, I have a recommendation. And this is one of the most embarrassing recommendations I think I've ever had. And the reason is that we all know if you get into a perfect position in a perfect mood with the perfect people, you will enjoy something that you might not otherwise enjoy. All right. So last night, the family and I got together, and the kid's a big Kevin Hart fan.
Mm.
That's okay.
And so I was this close, mind you, to watching Get Hard.
Mm.
Now that would have been very dangerous. Mm-hmm. Because first of all, it's rated R, so it's a little outside of his range right now. And second of all, I think that has been on record as sucking hard.
It's also pretty offensive.
That's like, what I hear. That's
homophobic.
Yeah. So that's why we didn't pull the trigger on that one. So, Kevin Hart movie that we haven't seen yet, Night School.
Ah.
Featuring Tiffany Haddish and a bunch of people that are a little better than you may think. Okay.
Did you say you're recommending this movie?
Yeah. It's not good. It's not good. Okay. This is on par with maybe Fist Vacation, Fight? Maybe The House. Okay. Maybe like okay. This is not a good movie.
I heard your preface where you said if you're with the right group of people at the right time. I just wanted to make sure you were recommending and then
we absolutely way. We absolutely loved the experience of watching this movie. Kevin Hart, it's so stupid. God damn. Kevin Hart is like a mid-level employee salesman, but he's really, really good at it. But he's never finished his high school diploma. And so in order to get a new job with even more money, he has to go to night school, who is taught by Tiffany Haddish. Now, Tiffany Haddish is not in her girls trip mode. She's not in her regular stand-up comedian mode. She's got a little textured performance here, which I was not expecting because I don't think I've ever seen Tiffany Haddish not on. You know what I mean? Yep. Especially as activated as she was in Girls Trip. So she's really good. Kevin Hart is loud and annoying, but I think he's just leaned into that, and that's going to go how it's going to go. The best part about this movie is the supporting cast. So his night school chums are played by Rob Riggle, Mary Lynn Rauchkub, and Fat Joe, and who's not as bad as you think. Romy Malco from 40-Year-Old Virgin. Mm-hmm. And my favorite out of this whole thing is Al Madrigal. If you remember him from The Daily Show, he plays this waiter that Kevin Hart inadvertently got fired. And he's hilarious. Mary Lynn Rauchkub is actually a comedian. We forget that because of all of her years on Chloe, as Chloe on 24. Chloe. Can you imagine that spinoff?
How many years Chloe. On Chloe?
It's Chloe. She's got a gun and a pewter.
Right after Joey.
Right after Joey. But they all work really well together. Rob Riggle is not his typical manic dude. And it's charming. The whole thing is charming. And I would recommend it for anybody that's looking for, like, man, I just need to laugh a little bit right now. I always hesitate to say turn your brain off. But just enjoy some light entertainment. And I don't think you'll be disappointed. The other two people, especially if you're Middle Ditch and Schwartz fans, Ben Schwartz plays his best friend, and he's brilliant as always. And Taron Killam plays his old Kevin Hart's old high school rival, and he's charming. He's got a lot more like texture to him than you would expect to see too. So, is this going to blow your socks off? No. But it was charming, and I liked it, and I'll probably watch it again.
All right.
That's my recommendation.
I've got a Blu-ray somewhere. I'll have to watch it some point.
I'll tell you what it was nice to see. Romy Malco, who I know has been in other stuff since 40-Year-Old Virgin. I just haven't really seen him very often, and he is hilarious. His delivery is so good. And the way that you can tell he's one of those actors, and I think comedians are uniquely good at this. He's one of those actors that listens. You know what I mean? One example is when I watched Destination Wedding with Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder, and you could tell they were just waiting for their turn to talk. and reading the dialogue.
Yeah.
You can tell with comic actors in particular, and even with Middleditch and Schwartz in, you know, the extreme, they really listen to each other so that they can have that spur of the moment reaction that breeds more comedy than just the dialogue itself. Mm-hmm. And Romany Malco, I think, has that ability.
Yeah.
So I appreciate seeing that stuff. All right, let's do this. Questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
I have recently been watching the Rocky series of movies again. God bless you, as it's been a long time since I last saw them all the way through. I forgot how brilliant the first one is and had forgotten that it won 3 Oscars. Did it indeed. Mm-hmm. Each subsequent sequel dips in quality, of course. So my question is this. What film series with a solid first movie gets unnecessarily forgotten or has been tainted by its lackluster sequels and or reboots? Love this question, and I also love that lackluster is spelled R-E at the end.
Yeah, which means, it means we have somebody from the British lands.
You spell like you're from London.
That's right. Now, this question is so specific that there are very few series that actually do this to the letter.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like to wash Rocky out of people's heads, you had to do something serious, right? Like you had to, yeah, you did some serious damage with those sequels. But the one that came to mind for me was Halloween, the original Halloween.
Yeah.
Because after that, you know, Carpenter makes a straight up sequel. It's the same night or the next morning or whatever for Halloween 2, and it's not nearly as good. And then Halloween 3, they tried to go into a different direction with the series, that they were going to try to make a different kind of Halloween movie without Michael Myers and all this. And then, you know, 4, 5, 6 and Resurrection and H2O and Josh Hartnett and bullshit. And,
you know, and Busta Rhymes.
Yeah, and Busta Rhymes and, you know, H2O found footage. Then the Rob Zombie reboots, and then the other reboot that came out a few years ago that's like, well, none of those other Halloweens except the first one exist. It's hard if you go through all those Halloween movies, you'll forget how brilliant the first one is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. First one is just brilliant based on just a lot of just very simple things that nobody, I don't think, has the balls to do anymore with horror movies a lot of times, because it's methodical about how it's setting everything up. It uses the frame in a certain way. Now everything is like, we got to make sure we have a jump scare within 10 seconds, mm-hmm. You know? So, I think Halloween is something that fits under that. Although very few people actually just forget about the original Halloween. Like, I think a lot of people just end up going, well, that first one's good. And that's what it comes down to with Rocky. While you have the degradation in quality that goes down over the years, it's not enough to be like, I think the only real terrible one is like Rocky 5.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all the ones in between are like, they're basically good. They're not the first one, but you know, so they don't.
I totally agree. I love all of them. Absolutely. Objectively, the first one is the best and most enjoyable. But I love me some 2 and 3 and Clubber Lang. And
yeah, but in the case of Rocky, those movies became different kinds of movies.
Yeah. Yep.
So then it's easy to forget that the first Rocky is a very 70s, you know, film. Yep. Very 70s film. But anyway.
That's a good call. I'm going to do 2. I'll try and go fast.
I want to go fast.
The Fast and the Furious is the Comcast of movie franchises, which is also, you know, Comcast owns Universal. So
indeed,
a double entendre there. But Comcast used to just sell me cable TV. And then when the internet exploded, they're like, oh, we got to pivot and get some of that market. And today, Comcast sells home phone service, home security systems, internet, and cable TV. The Fast and Furious is like this. They started out as a humble
attractive cast, car racing heist movie. And it's just over time pivoted so many times that it's James Bond superheroes now. And I can't remember the last time they just had a good old fashioned car race in one of these movies between two characters that were both cocky. Fast and Furious, the first one it's not great. It's no Rocky. I'm not making that comparison. But if you take it for what it is and you forget what the series became, that's a charming little film. The other one I wanted to mention is Meet the Parents. I feel like Ben Stiller has a problem with unnecessary sequels between this trilogy, The Night at the Museum, the Madagascar movies.
Mm-hmm. Zoolander.
But the first Meet the Parents is pretty charming. If you watch it now, there's very few moments of cringe. De Niro is playing great off of his, you know, usual tough guy persona. There's plenty of laughs. And then they had to go and like bring in Dustin Hoffman and was it Bette Midler? No, it's the other one, Barbara Streisand.
The other one.
Six of one, half dozen of the other.
You know, usually there's a package deal. Bette Midler and Barbara Streisand.
The other one.
Get one or the other.
Same thing. But again, you know, then they did Meet the Fockers with the little kids, and it just gets less funny. You know, comedies should almost never have sequels. The Hangovers did this too. But the first Meet the Parents is fine. It's charming. You can watch it again and you'd laugh. And they just ruined it by stomping it into the ground. There you go. There's my two answers.
I like it. One thing I was thinking about, because you're right, Chris, this is a very specific question. I had originally put Jaws on my list, but nobody forgets about Jaws because of the subsequent sequels. Everybody knows that Jaws is Jaws.
Yeah.
But it's very specific with Rocky. I've got my true answer, but I just thought about the View Askew-iverse or Skewverse. When you think about how minimalist Clerks was by nature, and even though they had a bigger budget, Mallrats, even though it ain't a perfect movie, you know, it is contained in one location. It doesn't really have, you know, this breadth or anything like that. And then you get Chasing Amy, and then we love Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back and everything. We don't like Jersey Girl, although that I don't think that's in the View Askew-verse. I did not like Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, but I think some of that world building and Dogma is in there too, even though I kind of like Dogma, is dissipating the clout that Clerks had initially. Because when you look at Kevin Smith now, he's more known as podcaster. He's known as, you know, a filmmaker that does whatever he wants to, a Twitter presence, an influencer. You don't think about him as the seminal director behind Clerks, whereas you think of Quentin Tarantino as director Quentin Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just one thing that popped into mind. But I think the other perfect example of this also has to be a Stallone vehicle. Because you ain't never seen anything more polar opposite from First Blood, which is not even named Rambo First Blood. It's called First Blood to Rambo First Blood Part 2. Certainly not Rambo 3, where he really got juiced up and slicked up and oiled up. And then Rambo 4, there was a Rambo 4, right?
Yeah, there was a John Rambo, like he did just like he did with the Rocky franchise, where it was like 15 to 20 years later.
There's, you know, one in the middle though too, right?
No. I think it went from 3 to, whereas Rocky went from, you know, 1, 2, 3 up to 5 and then did Rocky Balboa. I think Rambo went to 3. And then they did Rambo, right?
Yes.
I don't know what we're interrupting about. What I'm saying is that Rambo did the same thing as Rocky Balboa did.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I just meant there was another.
I don't understand what your point is here.
All I'm saying is there's 5 of them, and it sounded like we were saying there was 4 of them. That's all.
I was getting to the point that there wasn't a Rambo 4, but there was a Rambo that came out later on.
And you're right. It's 20 years later. You're absolutely
right. Trying to get to that point. There was the one that was in the mid-aughts that came out. And then he came out with that other Rambo that was like 2 years ago or whatever, that where he's old as fuck.
Super R-rated Home Alone version.
Yeah. What was that one called? Last Blood.
Last Blood. Yeah.
But listen, you can objectively say, now listen, I've watched Rambo 2 many, many times. First Blood Part 2. And I've enjoyed it. This is the one that's really parodied hard in Hot Shots Part 2. I have seen Rambo 3. Don't remember anything about it except for buttered up arms. Never, I haven't even seen the Rambo ones that came out in the mid-aughts, and I haven't seen Last Blood, but I haven't heard anything fantastic about them. And even so, those movies, especially the 2 through 3, are so coked up, steroided up, 80s-ified versions of a character that has no business being in those, that I think it's very, very much like Rocky. And this is Sly's career arc, is going from, you know, a screenwriter, an auteur almost, to this action star that barely resembles anything that he did before. First Blood is a minimalist, beautiful survival pick. That you can watch anytime, any day. It's not really gratuitous. It's pretty much the story of the traumatized Vietnam War vet, and has some beautiful acting between Richard Crenna and Sly Stallone at the end of that movie that has been parody for sure. But it's also incredibly textural. I think You really sense the emotions there. It wasn't my war. Nothing is over. That'll give you real chills. I think Rambo goes right to the heart of this question.
Man, the first time I saw First Blood, I was shocked, just because you know Rambo has this persona, right? I was not allowed to watch First Blood growing up. I probably was too young anyway to even know about it. But when the sequels came out, that's all I thought Rambo was: buttered up arms and. You know, a vest made of bullets, and and then you go back and watch that first one, which I was way late to, and it's not only is it not the same kind of movie at all, it's fan fucking tastic.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
Good call.
Yeah, this is something that's also unique to Stallone too. But I mean, what you're getting at about Rocky and Rambo, because very few action stars started off in the 70s like he did, where movies were still being made a certain way, and it was like pre-Star Wars and everything like that. And then the First Blood is an 80s movie, but it's still on the fringe of the 70s.
Oh, for sure.
So they're still sort of making movies that have some thoughtful way of constructing their story and everything. They're not ready to go into this full-on action and everything. Like, the 80s became that cocaine blitz, you know, somewhere in the middle 80s, and especially with these, like, the Vanya Kassar team that did all these Rambo movies later on. So you see these thoughtful, like, Rocky and First Blood, and then as it gets into the cocaine 80s, it starts becoming the completely different things. And I don't know of any other stars that could really say that. Schwarzenegger became big in the 80s. So everything he did was in that cocaine fueled, you know, whatever. And it's another Vanya Kassar thing, Terminator. Was his big break and everything. But he was Schwarzenegger's always been, I think, considered an 80s guy, even though he had a few movies before that. Stallone is unique. I don't know if there's anybody else that could say that they've been in a franchise like that, much less two, and had to deal with the difference in the decades like he did.
I think he's got more I mean, I'm talking out of my ass a little bit here, but I think he's got more respect and clout from a performance and filmmaker standpoint than anybody like Bruce Willis or Schwarzenegger or Vin Diesel or The Rock has really ever had, because he's shown his range over time. And I think those bona fides in the 70s really solidified that.
Mm-hmm.
Bona.
I just came across a thread on Reddit that posed the question, what film characters have you fallen in love with? I surprised myself with how few I came up with, but I liked how it got me thinking about which characters I could see myself having a deeper connection to, as opposed to just finding them or the actors playing them attractive. What do you guys, who characters have you fallen in love with?
So Amelie,
Yes.
Although, you know, now that I've said it out loud, I am sitting there thinking about what a relationship with Amelie would be like. And I'm wondering if I would like that at all. Like, I love it in the movie, but would I like that in the relationship? I'm not sure. But Amelie is someone that I've fallen in love with. I don't think I've seen, and I like Audrey Tautou a lot, but I don't think I've seen Audrey Tautou in another role where I'm like, oh, I'm in love with her or anything like that. I mean, she's been in like Da Vinci Code.
Yeah. How about that?
Like, yes. Yeah, exactly. Stuff like that. Rosemary Cross, played by Olivia Williams in Rushmore, is another one that I've fallen in love with. And Annie, Sandra Bullock in Speed.
You can't start off with intense situations or sex, though. Or I guess that's, you can start off with sex.
Yeah, but then you could always be the Jason Patrick and swoop in after Keanu Reeves.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, how was that explained, by the way? I forgot Speed 2.
Well, they broke up.
Well, I think they said because the intense situations, they brought that up.
Yeah, they just leaned into it. Yeah. You know, it was Demolition Man and Speed, 1-2 punch of Sandra Bullock cuteness there for me. That's a good pick. I fell in love very, very much with Penny Lane in Almost Famous, which I think probably everybody does. Oh, don't get me wrong. Listen, you've heard some stories about my college girlfriends. I'm attracted often to the wrong type of people. but everybody in that movie is in love with Penny Lane in some manner. And, you know, she shot really well. But credit to Kate Hudson for playing that character so perfectly. But from my childhood, it was Cindy Mancini, played by Amanda Peterson in Can't Buy Me Love, which is Patrick Dempsey.
Yeah.
Pays the popular girl to date him for a month or so that he can get popular. And she starts to fall for him. But once he gets popular, he dumps her because he's an asshole. I don't think she did a lot of acting after this, because I looked her up
either
a couple days ago when I did prep for this. But man, she was my secret girlfriend for like a year and a half. She didn't know.
And that was that great scene where Patrick Dempsey's like, am I a bet? Am I a fucking bet? Everybody remembers that.
Yes, exactly.
It's funny. Are you done? I'm sorry.
I'm done. Yes.
It's funny you mentioned Almost Famous, because I kind of fell in love with all the Band-Aids, like Anna Paquin, Fairuza Balk.
Does anybody remember Laughter?
Let's deflower the kid.
Another Anna Klumsky. Was my imaginary girlfriend in My Girl. You know, I wanted her to look at me the same way she looked at Macaulay Culkin before he died.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to give the ball to Marshawn Lynch, but I died. So that was my childhood one. I've covered Christina Ricci. I'll tell you one person that worked her way into my heart almost immediately. It was from her stand-up. It was from her brief appearance in The Cable Guy. And it probably solidified during for Wet Hot American Summer, Janeane Garofalo. Garofalo, for whatever reason, her character Beth in Wet Hot American Summer is just so chill, but also so funny and so pretty in an unusual way. I've loved her since I saw her at improv. I saw her on Reality Bites in The Cable Guy and stuff like that. So I've kind of just stalked her from afar. Anyway, we'll move off of that. Speaking of hot messes, like Penny Lane, I would love to get my hands on Anne Hathaway's character from Love and Other Drugs.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus.
Oh, my God.
She's a talk about a bad idea.
Talk about a bad idea.
Oh, you know, my goodness. But I feel like we would have such a nice time together.
They've been naked together a couple times.
Yep. Brokeback
and Love and Other Drugs.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, they feel comfortable naked.
Mainly Love and Other Drugs, though.
Well, yes, but she does get naked in Brokeback.
She does. I'm saying that like the bulk of it, the 95% of it, isn't that Love
and Other movie is all nudity, isn't it?
All nakedness.
It is. Like, you don't really see a great many movies like that these days. Like, R-rated romance with a lot of, like, sadness built in, like some themes about corruption in the medical supply industry. Like that movie's a unicorn. It's not very good.
Not a good one.
It's a unicorn.
It's like kind of unicorn that shits on your porch.
Yeah.
It's rare, but exactly. You still don't want it coming around.
It's the type of movie where a doctor tells a woman to take off her shirt just so that he can look at her boobs.
Yes.
Hank Azaria.
Yes,
that's
he does.
Not good. That's not good. But no. She's delightful. There's something in her that I want to touch.
Yeah.
The last one is I'm torn between this because I think I could have a relationship with Adam Driver's character in Black Klansman because he's so pure of heart. He's so committed to his job. He's so easygoing, even in the conversations that he has with John David Washington when they're, you know, gathering evidence and stuff like that. He's not over dramatic about things. Like, he'll talk about his Jewishness, but it never really was like a big concern to him. But now that it's being pointed out all the time, he's starting to be concerned. So he seems like an honest dude. He's blazingly hot. And hey, he's got a good job. He's on the Boulder, Colorado police office thing.
That scene where John David Washington's on the phone and he's asking for some reading materials and he starts going through all these like racial epithets and everything, and Adam Driver, they cut to Adam Driver, who like just very slowly turns in his chair while he's looking at all this going on. It's one of the best. Oh, it's so good.
Oh, he's fantastic. I was thinking maybe his character from Marriage Story, because I think he's misunderstood. I think they're both misunderstood. And that's kind of the point of Marriage Story. But he's a little too volatile for me in Marriage Story. This is a very straightforward question, but I love it. What is the most famous performance by your favorite actor? What's your favorite performance by them? My favorite, this person's favorite, is Donald Pleasance. He plays Dr. Loomis in Halloween, of course.
Jonathan Watkins turning in a question.
That's right. Seriously. From Jonathan W. from south of Nashville. My favorite Donald Pleasant role of his is Ellis Fowler in the Twilight Zone episode, The Changing of the Guard. I do remember that episode, and he's awesome in that. He's got awesome performances all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you guys think?
I'm going to go with it's hard for me to know who my favorite actor is, but I know that one actor that is always just consistently great in everything that I've ever seen him in is Paul Newman.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And it's hard to really pinpoint what his most famous one is. I think it's either The Hustler or Color of Money or Cool Hand Luke, which is maybe the more famous movie out of that group. I'm not sure. But the performance that I think is my favorite of his is The Verdict. I don't know if you guys have ever seen The Verdict.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
But this is a guy who is, he's not a good lawyer anymore. Anyway, he's an ambulance chaser. He's going to people's funerals and giving out cards to people he doesn't even know. He's got this one case that he thinks he can just settle out of court and just make a bunch of money and not care about it or whatever. But as he starts investigating it and he starts talking to people, and he talks to the one turning point in the verdict that I love is he's talking to this doctor, and the doctor is telling him about the case and saying, yeah, these doctors really fucked this up. This is a slam dunk case. And he's like, well, we're going to settle out of court. And he's like, why would you do that? You can sue these guys for millions of dollars for what they did and everything. And you can see him in his mind, maybe at first it's for the money. He's like, oh, we could do more for the money, blah, 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 blah. But it's a typical Hollywood thing for an actor to do an alcoholic, but it's not that fall over everything. Like, it's not to the point of leaving Las Vegas or something like that. He's got a real problem, but it's not to the point of, just ruining the movie almost, that, you see beer, he's like crashing through beer bottles when he gets home and stuff like that. But his performance in that is unreal. And I love it when the verdict is read and just the look on his face during that at the end. By the way, if you guys out there haven't seen The Verdict, that is a must watch movie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of sneaky, he had so much of the, charity stuff and the condiment empire. He's got a sneaky, great last half of his career.
Yeah.
Between Road to Perdition, The Verdict, mm-hmm. and even, the Cars, starting off in the Cars franchise. In the meantime, he's still racing until he's in his 60s or something like mm-hmm. that.
I don't think we should ever talk about Paul Newman without mentioning his food brand that he started and grew into a multi-million dollar company that donates every cent of profits. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they pay off their expenses and their employees, but they are not in business to make money. They're in business. They sell pasta sauce and salad dressing so that they can help people who have nothing. And that's just, mm-hmm. that's my favorite piece of his legacy. He was a fantastic actor, loved racing, but he was an even better human being.
Yeah.
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 My two favorite actors are Chris Pine and Denzel. I'm going to give you one for each. Chris Pine is probably most known for Star Trek, acting-wise, probably most well-regarded for Hell or High Water. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you, his performance in Horrible Bosses 2 goes for it. I don't think I would like this movie as much if he wasn't all in. And I think, that may be what kept the first one from being as good, because Colin Farrell wasn't maybe as all like Chris Pine is having the time of his life playing this rich kid who hates his dad and wants to get in on the fake kidnapping scheme. He just relishes that. Anyway, Denzel is probably most known for Training Day or his early stuff like Glory. But I honestly do think his best performance is Courage Under Fire, which again is a man battling demons with alcohol. And if you haven't seen that movie, there's a couple different scenes. One, when he's outside the car watching his kids play, and his wife comes out to the car and basically says, you have to leave or the kids are going to see you, cause he's drunk. It's powerful shit. And then there's another time where he calls her and he says, I'm thinking about having a drink. And she's like, well, you don't have to. And he's like, this phone booth in the rain. And just, it's gut wrenching watching this man navigate his own demons, in order to get to the truth of this story. I love that movie. I'm not saying it's an A++ for everybody, but that performance I think gets overlooked a lot.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Good call. Yeah, the first person, it's weird. If you asked me and I had time to think about it, who my favorite actor is, I probably wouldn't have said George Clooney, but for some reason, he's the first one that popped into my mind, because he has a lot of my favorite performances. Now, as a director, mm-hmm. not so much. Obviously, and I spent a lot of time thinking about this, I don't think you can say he's got a more famous portrayal than Danny Ocean in the Oceans franchise. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that he's more well known for Out of Sight, or some of his Coen stuff that he's done, especially Burn After Reading and things like that. He's great as Danny Ocean in these movies, even the ones that like 12 that I don't like very much. He's not the problem with it. He actually has a pretty magnetic performance. That shot of him, which we parodied in the outtake in the video, the Sense video, where he's just looking at Vincent Cassell and really putting him on blast. I love it.
Yeah.
But my favorite performance from George Clooney, I think, is probably Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Any of his Coen Brothers stuff is great, but he's given so much to do as Ulysses Everett McGill in this unique, wholly unique character. He's a loudmouth that knows it all, but he also does have some knowledge. He's obsessed with his hair. He's able to, you know, to get his family back together eventually. He's able to outsmart the powers that be. And so he really does have the, quote, hero's journey based on Ulysses in that movie. And I still think that's a little bit of an underrated or underseen movie. I also would throw in it From Dusk Till Dawn, but that's not really worth watching.
Well, that was a good one, though, to shed him from his ER thing, because he was such a bad guy in that movie. And everything.
Yeah, he was a badass, too.
What is the line in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where he's asking for the Dapper Dan, and the guy's like, it's a 7 days. Does he say seven
it's
days?
2 weeks. So, he's like, ain't this a geographical oddity? 2 weeks away from everything.
Those lines. Oh, and he just sinks his teeth into them, man. They're so good.
He was committed because he wanted to do the singing, and he tried. Not good enough. But he was throwing himself into that role for sure.
Yeah. Before I get into the final spiel here, I didn't do my review of all the recommends and warns.
Oh, right.
Jeremy warned Liberal Arts, the Josh Radnor flick where he writes, directs, and stars in with Elizabeth Olsen. I recommended In and Of Itself, which is on Hulu, and Barrett recommended Night School. Kevin Hart.
I can't believe that you're even saying that.
I know. I can't either. But that's going to do it for this week. Keep going to Sincast presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. We're also on CinemaSins Twitter, Music Video Sins Twitter, and we're on SoundCloud, and we're on Discord. If you want to get on Discord, you can go to our Reddit page and find a link on the right side there, or you can private message me on Facebook, and I can give you a link from there. That's going to do it for this episode. It's Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Barrett Sherr. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
Ophelia, I got out a little bit early. I went about 9. And I went in the sweet spot because Publix, they were like, we just restocked and we're going to get slammed this afternoon. So this was a good time to come in. And I was like, because we ate all the food from the last ice storm. Right. And I was like, if we're going to get through until Saturday, we need a little bit more, especially the growing kid. And so I get out, Chris knows my driveway is like 45 degree angle. So I was slipping going back off of it, but I had salt. So I threw that on there. And then when I was coming up, I was like, either I could put this into low and inch my way up there and probably slide or just fucking nail it and see what happens. So I've nailed it. I got up and I was fist bumping. I was like, yeah, man, I got food. Like everything's cool. And then I realized I forgot my medication that I had to pick up from Kroger. And I was like, I need that today. And so I took another stab at it. And in that 30 minutes or so, there was probably 1,000% more traffic on the roads. Ugh. So not only are you having to deal with, you know, the slippage and all that stuff. You're having to deal with other people who can't handle the slippage. And that was fraught with all kinds of madness.
Yeah, I was stupid, man. I went to the store. When did the storm happen? Monday night? Sunday night?
Sunday it started getting slick. And then Sunday night into Monday.
I don't think I knew that there was going to be that kind of snow coming down. And I thought it would be melted away.
Yeah, like it always is.
The next day.
Yeah.
So I went to the store not to go there because of snow happening, just because it was a general whatever. And I didn't buy any extra things or whatever. And just was like, okay, this is going to be your normal shit. Now I'm sitting here on Wednesday and I'm like down to my last couple of days of food and everything. Yeah. And of course I'm not that much of an asshole to get Uber Eats to come out here and fucking give me anything. Although I have done a very asshole thing and ordered stuff off Amazon, which I don't know how they're going to deliver, but yeah, I was sitting there like I was sitting there thinking after I got back and I started hearing about how bad it was going to be and everything. I was like, fuck, I was just there. I could have bought all sorts of shit. No. Just all sorts of shit. Cause there was nobody there. Like I just bought everything I wanted and it would have been fine. And I would have been the smartest person in the entire town. Instead, I went straight down to the dumbest. I have enough to get through today, tomorrow, probably Friday.
Yeah, you should be all right.
You'll be all right.
That should be all right.
And so then once Friday rolls around, now that is just variety of food. If I wanted to, I could eat oatmeal all day if I wanted to, or eggs or anything like that, that I've got plenty. But
it's been 5 days since my ketchup ran out.
Yes, exactly.
Fuck, can you say some more?
Well, I can say a lot. I don't often because I'm a man of few words. You know, everybody knows me as a man who almost never talks. A man who says more with one word than most men can say with 20.
That's right.
I was watching that Richard Gere, the hoax movie again, because it was on. But I fucking love that scene where he's listening to Howard Hughes and he starts imitating him. And now, furthermore, and then like it just cuts to a scene where he's impersonating Howard Hughes doing this amazing impression into the microphone. Anyway. Now, furthermore, a pocket change of $5 million. Anyway,
but there was this weird moment on Friday, late in the day, where I was like, I want to watch Civil War, like Captain America Civil War.
Why?
I have no clue. But I was like, maybe I remember more about that fondly than I thought. And part of the reason is because I was watching WandaVision and it had the Lagos thing in it. And I was like, what was Lagos again? I remember Sokovia, New York and all that stuff. But oh, yeah, Lagos was in Civil War. I watched a little of that, and I ended up watching most of it. I skipped through a few of the boring bullshit, like Bucky killing the parents again, and everything building up to that fight. But then, god damn it, it was about 11 o'clock at night. Started watching Infinity War.
You got no one to blame but yourself on that shit.
Oh, my god. Because I had seen Winter Soldier fairly recently, and I was like, that was a little better than I remembered. Civil War, actually, that was a little better than I remembered, even though it's still completely ludicrous. And Infinity War gets better every time I watch it, I think. Endgame gets worse every time I watch it.
Yeah, Infinity War is the superior of those two, I believe. Never mind.
It's like wrapping yourself in a warm blanket. Like that's what those movies are intended to be, is wrapping yourself in a warm blanket. And just watching superheroes do superhero shit.
Okay. All right. Civil War, though, man. I can't forget that one.
You can't forget that one.
I just hate that movie.
From a logistical standpoint?
all kinds of standpoints. Every single person in that final fight is pulling their punches, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I continue to assert to this day that you could have written it with Cap and Tony on opposite sides of that disagreement, and I think it would have played just fine because, yeah, they didn't build that enough for me. It just kind of became, oh, let's have everybody fight each other in one big scene, and people will love it. And they did, and not me, because there's no motivation for any of it, and there's no consequences. And Rhodey gets shot out of the sky and has magic legs 30 seconds later.
That's true.
Almost everything that I hate about the MCU is most prominent in Civil War, I think.
Yeah, you're right. Everything around the fighting, though, is good, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
All these characters have different motivations all of a sudden to be on whatever side that they're on in that battle and everything. Yeah. I think we wore out Ant-Man on the fact that, you know, the whole first movie he was in was like, I got to avoid jail. I got to see my daughter. And then he's on fucking Cap's side in that fucking battle. And
there's one line, man, where he's just like, you'll be a criminal. And he's like, yeah, what's new?
Like, no, right. No, you didn't spend a whole goddamn movie with you trying to see your daughter that, you know, that basically you can't say that anymore. And, you know, Tony just being able to find Spider-Man and then bringing a kid into the battle and all this other, you know, I mean, there's so many things wrong with that.
You would not bring a 15-year-old into that battle, and that fucking Spider-Man does not change the course of the battle, goddammit. Mm-hmm. Why'd you even say Civil War, Barrett? I don't want to fight about this.
There is no change of the battle. But yeah, it is, because it's funny. I think your major problem is that battle. And I understand that, but I like everything else around it. I like the addition of Black Panther coming in. I like the addition of Spider-Man coming in, even though it's ridiculous. I like the Wanda being an Avenger, especially after getting more in tune with her character in WandaVision. I like the embiggened Ant-Man. But yeah. Everything about that. I mean, even fucking Clint and Black Widow are like, we're still friends after this, right? And Wanda's like, you're pulling your punches. I'm like, fuck you.
I don't like any of the Daniel Brühl stuff either. All that's a bunch of nonsense. The thing that's unforgivable in that movie to me is Tony being so emotional about seeing his parents dying that he decides he's going to start battling Cap and Bucky because, oh, Cap knew about it and didn't tell me. And like, what does it matter? What does it fucking matter? You knew Bucky was under a mind control. He's not doing that on his own. So just because Cap saw it in a brief scene, like that, he knew that that was happening. You know what I mean? Tony's like, you knew? Oh my God, let's battle over this shit. Oh my God. That whole ending is problematic.
Yep.
And people love it, man. And it's almost whenever you say something to the effect that, you know, that I feel like is a good point about those things, they're always, the people who love it are always like, no, that's what I loved. Oh my God. Blah, blah, blah. That's what you loved. Seriously. I don't think I heard you say that until I said I hated it.
Yep.
With Cap, he heard something. He saw something. But like after he gets his anger out, he's still going, man. He's like, I want to murder this guy for not telling me that his best friend, who's mind controlled, killed my parents.
Is this even a guy who would get that upset about his nothing parents about, being dead 30 years about, ago?
Well, no. I think they're trying to set up the emotional stakes of it with that first scene at MIT where he's going through that whole
right, but no prior
thing.
Movie has made nope. him, I love my parents so much. In fact, prior movies have made his dad like complex and
a
not
cockhole. Yeah.
Not like maybe the kind of dad who was gone all the time and wasn't around for Tony. So you find out 30, 40 years after he's dead, you find out the person that killed him and Tony's just going to go what? Like insane? That doesn't make any sense at all.
Real Tony would be like, oh, that's interesting. Take a drink. Like,
there's gotta be a better setup to that fight happening than what they came up with. Mm-hmm. I think the filmmakers think it is the most stunning revelation ever that Bucky, while mind controlled in parentheses, killed his parents. And they seem to forget that, it's like the filmmakers forget that he's mind controlled, and they forget that Tony knows that, and Tony just gets totally upset about it and fucking, oh my God, man. Yeah. I mean, I think people hold Winter Soldier too high up in regard, and
Winter Soldier doesn't have any logistical holes in it as much as Civil War, except for Nick Fury being able to carve through the fucking concrete of the road to get out.
Well, and that was something we send in the video, and people were like, well, if you watch the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you'll see that they have that technology and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, fuck you and your Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Nobody gives a fuck about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's one of those Lord of the Rings, why does Gandalf go to research the ring after he sees Sauron in the ring type of things where, you know, in the book, he doesn't touch the ring because he's like, I better not touch that shit. And in the movie, they're like, we better have him touch that shit so that we can show Sauron.
Then they kill her husband and they feel really guilty.
Man, I love me some Elizabeth Olsen.
She's growing on me. I like her a lot. The first few times I saw her, like that Marcy Magdalene May vagina. her character is so catatonic almost that acting wise it wasn't a showy role. And then I see her in Godzilla next and I'm like, I don't really know here, but yeah, the more I watch her, the more I think she's got great talent.
God, I forgot she was in Godzilla. I think I've forgotten that entire movie. I remember King of the Monsters more than I remember the 2014.
See, it's the opposite for me, because
there's another reference they could do in WandaVision with Elizabeth Olsen and Aaron Taylor Johnson is that one.
Some people think they did because, shit, what was the... It felt like a stretch to me, but I read an article... and somebody was counting up all the references and somebody says a line that reminded somebody of a line said in Godzilla. And they tried to connect that thread as though the show was referencing Godzilla, but I didn't buy it.
Yeah. I mean, that would have to be pretty obvious. Like that kick-ass line, just the way they did it in that,
right,
that show. I was like, there's no way they had Evan Peters say kick-ass and Elizabeth Olsen just think to herself, kick-ass. Without that being a thing.
Yeah.